Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at KBOO.FM. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such primetime players as Jason Moran, Diane Reeves, Christian McBride, Terrence Blanchard, and John Scofield. The weekly program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium. It can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu at kboo.fm, clicking on Audio, then Podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. New shows are posted weekly. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Monday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the second annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride at 7 p.m. at the Bowie Bike Lane at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main on January 8th in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage on the community events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hi, this is Emma with Prison Pipeline, and at the beginning of the show, I just want to provide a disclaimer. There was a band that was recording here at KBOO, and some of the noise did get into this interview, so there will be a little bit of bleeding over later in the interview. So my apologies, and I hope you enjoy this interview with Jessica Tibbetts. All right. Good evening and welcome to our special New Year's edition of Prison Pipeline. My name is Emma Lugo and I'm a co-host, and I'm here tonight with Jessica Tibbetts. Jessica, so you were on a panel this fall at the Women in Prison Conference where you talked about domestic violence. Can you share a little bit of your story?
Okay, well, so what I was speaking on in October was basically domestic violence and how it leads to women in prison. I spoke about how I kind of have a unique perspective because the people who were supposed to protect me didn't. No one stepped up to protect me. And when doctors, because I had doctors called DHS, and police officers, different people stepped in, DHS did never investigate, you know, even though I had spent the first 5 years of in foster care and there was a history of it. I wasn't on their radar. They didn't, like, I hit their radar, but they just didn't want to open that can of worms. And part of it was because I was a serial runaway. Mm-hmm. Like, I was a pain in the butt. I constantly ran away. I felt like when I was raped, if I didn't fight or if I didn't say, oh my gosh, he raped me, but he had a knife to my throat, right? It was my own guilt and my shame. Mm-hmm. And that I sensationalized it because I believed that the people who were in a position to help me wouldn't think that it was a quote unquote big deal just because they raped me. Because I grew up in a place of a strong rape culture where there was a lot of victim shaming. There was a lot of denial. You're a liar. You're dirty. And so growing up in that, I learned to sensationalize, oh my gosh, he beat me up and he raped me, when really I was feeling guilt because I had PTSD and I disassociate when things happen to me. Like, if I can't stop it and I try, because I did, no, stop, please, you know, and you fight for a while, but then they put their hand on your throat or something. And I believe that wasn't a big deal. That no matter how much it hurt me, no one was going to care. And a lot of times that was my reality too, because a lot of times people in a position to help me, or the people that were quote unquote supposed to protect me as a child, they didn't, and they didn't care. And you know, a lot of people after I fell or went to prison, this crime happened, they stepped up and they were like, well, we figured something was happening, or we this or we that. But well, the but is just a cop out. You know, it's a lot easier for a person to say, hey, you're a liar. And for even people, good people, to convince themselves that this can't be true, because you don't want to see the human depravity that exists. You don't want to see the violence in the twisted, horrific things that people can do to other people. Mm-hmm. And growing up in that, that's how I got into this situation.
Are you angry at the people who didn't catch that when you were a child? I mean, who took you out of foster care, put you back with your parents, and then didn't pay attention to the signs that they should have?
I mean, the system would want me to say, no, I'm over that. No, I am. I still get pissed off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm supposed to trust my kids to this system. How the heck do I trust someone to protect me when there were glaring, like, warning signs and they just got smoothed over? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I'm pissed. I'm mad. Mm-hmm. I would not have ended up in the situation, ended up in prison, growing up in prison, had anyone have, you know, within a first year of me being returned from foster care, I was raped and my uterus was ripped. Where was the system then? You know, now people are starting to talk about rape. People are starting to talk about, you know, the victims, and, you know, that rape culture exists, because there's a strong rape culture. There's the victim shaming. There's the denial. There's the shunning, the public shunning, the making these people, you know, the whole blood is thicker than water thing. It stays in the family, right? There are people that want to silence people, and they've gotten away with it for years and decades and decades. And, you know, even as a child, I was done with that. Like, I sung like a little, no, this stuff is happening to me. And when people wouldn't listen, I would sensationalize it. And unfortunately, that made me look very manipulative, and it made me look like a liar, you know? And I
believe, people didn't believe you.
Yeah. You know, people didn't believe me. And finally, you know, when I was getting sentenced, the DA was like, well, we understand that the state of Oregon failed Miss Tibbetts. Well, you know, yeah. And it's unfortunate that I slipped through the cracks. But now I do have a mouthpiece. Now I am going to stand for those people. And I won't be silenced, because I do have a voice, mm-hmm. you know. And a lot of people, they're still afraid to say mm-hmm. that these things have happened, or to see their value, because it's hard. You know, I've had issues happen, serious things happen, even as a healthy grown person, that I didn't recognize for what they were, because I didn't have enough self-worth to recognize, hey, this happened to me and I should have prosecuted it, right? It's the, hey, I'm in a relationship. I asked him to stop, but, you know, we have a regular sexual relationship, you know, so it's okay. But that's rape culture that's been bred into me. And it took somebody else to be like, hey, you said stop. You kept saying stop, and you were injured. Like, mm-hmm. that's not okay. Like, as a responsible adult, there's a consenting part on each part. And when you say stop, stop means stop, right? And that's when somebody becomes a rapist, right? Mm-hmm. And a rapist is a rapist. You know, I don't care how you dress. I don't care how old you are. I don't care. Like, you know, if you use manipulation, if you use drugs to do that, you're a rapist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bottom line, there's no, it's really black and white. There's no gray area in this particular thing. And people will say, well, she was just 14 and I was 21. Well, there's a reason that those laws are in place. It's because an older person in a relationship can manipulate a younger person.
Mm-hmm.
And a younger person can be, they're impressionable. So they want to follow you. They want to do these things. Or, you know, like in my case, I didn't take my co-defendant seriously. I didn't really think that he was going to kill my mom and dad or my mom and brother. Like, I thought it was just talk, you know? And then I got myself into a very grown-up situation when it came very real in my face.
Mm-hmm.
And I froze. You know, I'm culpable because he told me he was going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I underestimated him. I was hateful, and I think part of me didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
At that time in my life, after all being brutalized, and I mean, it was probably bordering on torture. I wasn't even allowed to go to school. Like, where was the truancy people? Because I went to school an equivalent of maybe 3 years out of the entire 9 years I was supposed to be going to school.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were so many red flags that should have been caught.
Yeah.
And then people assuaged their guilt or their whatever by being like, oh, she slipped through the cracks. Oh, well, that was unfortunate, but she shouldn't have done what she did.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a point where I felt like it was life or death. Like, it was survival. And I didn't care if I died. I didn't care what happened as long as I got out and I never had to go back. Mm-hmm. And that was all I could see.
Mm-hmm.
And
was going to Coffee Creek a way of doing that, or did Coffee Creek just create more trauma for you?
Well, so my life in prison was better than any life I ever lived on the outside until now.
Mm-hmm.
Except for when I was a foster home, obviously, but I was, as a juvenile being in prison, as somebody who went in at 14, and I went through Hillcrest for like 2 years or something like that. And then going into adult prison and, you know, like my sweet 16, quote unquote, they walked me over from juvenile detention to adult jail. Okay. And I remember the cops thought it was really cool. They gave me a piece of gum for the one block walk in between jails. And then it was big red gum. And then they put me in a holding cell with this lady coming down from heroin. She kept puking up these little balloons full of drugs, right? And I kept trying to like make it better and feed her and stuff because she just kept vomiting everywhere. And she was horrifically sick. She just like, it was bad. And I remember, you know, she's like, hey, you know, she tried to give me one just to get me to leave her alone, I think. And that's what I remember my 16th birthday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was immediately thrown into a world of, like, drugs. My parents had done different stuff. My dad was an alcoholic. I have always, throughout my entire life, steered clear of that crap because I don't like what it does to people. To me, it destroys families. I see it destroy people. People will go from being a person that you love and you respect, and then you look at them and you're just like, who is this? Like, it destroys the person that you know. And I'm not willing to give up my identity to become a soulless. It's not that they lose their souls, but their souls get lost in the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And they become people that they'll lie, cheat, steal, anything. And so they lose the essence of their being to this addiction while they're addicted. I love recovering addicts. I love people who are current addicts. But I love them from a distance. And I refuse to give anything that kind of hold over me. I mean, my sex abuse, in a way, it has its own hold over me. And I believe that that was a direct result of domestic violence. And the domestic violence fed into the sex abuse. And I was completely vulnerable and unprotected as a result. And it led to me going to prison. And in Coffee Creek, I was a target. I was, you know...
At 16...
Well, I was 18 when I went to Coffee Creek. I got intaked at 16, but they kind of separated me from the population at that time. But I was immediately preyed upon by a female, and she was a sex offender. And I got into the most, like, that's how I learned that I had my mother's abuse cycle. So you select, once you... You're conditioned to believe something, right? And you select people. You model yourself behind your parents' relationships, whether or not you want to admit it. You'll be like, oh, hell no, I am nothing like that person, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I found a female horrifically like my father. Like, it was crazy how much she was like him. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting the crap beat out of me. And even in prison, they had to intervene and separate me. Like, they took her to the hospital one day, and these people came into my cell, like, six cops deep. And I didn't say anything about what was happening. But they were, like, six cops deep, and somebody else had seen, and they were like, she's going to kill her in that cell. And they pulled me out of that cell away from her and locked me in a different part of the prison where she couldn't get to me. And she was literally, like, in windows, banging on doors, paying people to try to get back at me and to get messages to me. And like, it was that serious. And I thought that that was love. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, she hit me. Yeah, she hurt me. Yeah, you know, all these things. But that was my picture in my head of, mm-hmm. of what love is, right?
Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of relationship that your mother had with your father?
The being cowed, not being able to speak, always walking on eggshells, the constant addiction. You know, that's exactly what my ex was. And, you know, I would just stay because I didn't want to be alone. And at that time, like, I had a second look. I didn't have a release date. So I was terrified that I was going to die alone and forgotten in prison, and I was just like, I was gonna end up a can on somebody's shelf. You know, I know that there, when somebody dies in prison and their family doesn't come claim them, they put a can up, they cremate them, and they keep their remains, their cremains, in OSP for, I think, 100 years, and then I don't know what they do with them.
Oh my goodness.
Like,
they didn't even get a pauper's grave. From
14 mm-hmm. on, like, all I could think is that I'm gonna end up
In a can
on somebody's shelf. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm going to ever be. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to love me. Nobody's going to care. I went, you know, years without a hug, without an I love you, without seeing a child and the innocence that is, the purity, right? Mm-hmm. And that was, it was like a living death. I felt dead mm-hmm. to everyone. And when you go to prison, everyone forgets.
How much of that was Coffee Creek and how much of that was your childhood?
Well, that was... The living death is all Coffee Creek. Like, all that's... Coffee Creek. Mm-hmm. Like, so the human... Level of human deprivation. You're not allowed to hug. You're not allowed to give gifts. You're not allowed to receive gifts. You're not allowed to... dance in a group. You're not allowed to, if they see that you're close to someone, they separate you because you become a threat. Mm-hmm. So you're not allowed to have relationships. You're not allowed to be in a sexual relationship with anyone. You're not allowed to,
any of the ways that people connect.
Yeah.
In a human level.
You know, you can hug sometimes, but it's with permission. I got threatened to be taken to the hole when I hugged my friend who was dying, and she was really scared, and I saw her, and it was actually, I think, the last time I saw her before she died, and we were going to do hospice on her, but she died in the hospital before we could, because I'm a hospice, I was a hospice caregiver in there as well. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I remember I saw her and she was sitting in a wheelchair in the corner of the infirmary, and she was normally in the infirmary, but she was like on the outside bubble. And so I ran up and I was going to give her a hug, and she's like, don't hug me, don't hug me, I don't want to get in trouble. And I was like, because I hugged this woman who has been locked in a cell away from everyone, can't even go to church, which is the kind of mingling place in there, and see people that she loves. She's locked in a cell in the corner of an infirmary by herself, right? She's dying. Like, the healthcare in there was just abysmal. And mm-hmm. you could see that she was dying in there. You know what I mean? And she's just alone and isolated and depressed. And I was like, screw you people. And so I hugged her, mm-hmm. you know? And that was actually the last time I saw her alive. And she had three boys, and she mm-hmm. died in there. Mm-hmm. She died in there. You know, and I don't know, was that the last time she got hugged?
Yeah.
Like, how do you know? I mean, on hospice, we get to hug them and stuff, but the fact of the matter is, like, there's just a level of deprivation, isolation, and seg. Like, there's what's called a closed soup cell where you're away from all the other inmates in the hole, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this is segregation now, but they used to be single bunked, right? Until they had population issues, where you were in a cell by yourself. The only communication you had was laying on the floor, talking out the bottom crack of your door. Okay? Mm-hmm. You got 5 books, 5 envelopes a week, 5 pieces of paper, a pen, and like, oh, you could have 5 sanitary napkins a day. So if you bled heavily, then you were screwed. Mm-hmm. You got 1 roll of toilet paper. So you had to hide stuff like that, right? So we would take threads out of the blankets and we would fish down the tier. We'd slide our comb, because we got 1 little tiny black comb, down the tier. And that was our human contact, right? Or up through the vent, the air vent that went up to the next bunk ahead of you. It was kind of connected. So we used to call it the telephone. So you'd talk to your person up there. But the closed soup cells had a door in front of your door. So you were completely isolated except for the person above you. And you would go, you know, like I did 120 days there. Like mm-hmm. 4 months.
4 months.
4 months of my life. You mm-hmm. know, I turned 19, 20, and 21, I think, in seg. Mm-hmm. Segregation, disciplinary segregation. We call it seg, or the whole. And it was like, you get out and it's almost like the movies where you're in that dark hole and like you see sunlight. Because you get an hour out a day, 5 days a week. They say that you're supposed to have an hour a day, I think, every day, but you don't actually get that. You get 5 hours a day. And then they count your shower time. You get 3 showers a week. They count your shower time on other days because they don't let you outside. That's your time out. And then you have to put your hands out of a cuff port backwards. And they clip a dog leash to it.
I've seen that, yeah.
And then they bring you out. And then they put you in a little tiny metal cage outside to walk in circles. Right? Mm-hmm. That's your life. And some people do years back there. So what you're creating by doing this, by putting people who've committed crimes, especially violent crime, because you're not eligible for any, if you have a long sentence, you're not eligible for any treatment. You're not eligible to do any of the classes. You're not eligible for as much of the mental health, because they're triaging people, right? So you don't get the opportunity to rehabilitate. So basically what they're doing is they're taking the most pissed off, violent, or the most criminal people, and they're like, sit on a shelf, right? We're going to take away all of your humanity, and you need to go ahead and rehabilitate yourself, because clearly these people don't have those skills, but they leave them on their own to do these things, right? You have to follow the rules in there or don't get caught. So mm-hmm. become a better criminal. So as a child, that's what I grew up in. And I had to make a decision as a kid. And I remember making a decision when I was like 14. Okay, I can be what everyone says I am. You know, I can just be a monster, and that's all that anyone expects me to be. No one expects anything more of me. Or I can choose to take things that I believe are important, that I believe are morality, like I want to be an honest person. I want to be able to give back. I don't want to hurt people. I didn't mean for that to happen. I don't want to be somebody who takes from everyone else. I want to give. What do I have to give? And I had to consciously make a decision. Okay, well, I had, 500 parents that were all convicted, or, one or two officers that I could, that were good people. You know, there were a handful of officers there that were actually good people. A lot of people let the power go to their head and it corrupts them. But a lot of times I had people, Carlin, Jennifer, different people that would step up, pepper spray you, or they're going to shoot you. There's a rifle that they shoot us with a taser round in it. And then they charge you. Anytime they have to do that, they charge you for the pepper spray. They charge you for the rifle round. They charge you.
They charge you money.
Yeah. They charge you money for anything. It's called a disciplinary fine. They charge you money for anything that goes wrong for them to get in trouble. And I feel like that's part of their hang up on how they get money, right? So they get thousands of dollars from people that way. And then they charge the money that's sent in to you as well, so that you can survive in there. They take part of that too now. So like the level of depravity that they have in there is just outrageous, right?
Well, Jessica, we're going to have to come back to this.
Okay.
In the future. And thank you so much for joining us tonight here at KBOO. If people want to find out more, is there some way that they can contact you, or if they want to learn more about domestic violence and how to look for signs of domestic or sexual violence in children? Do you have any recommendations for where people can go? And if they're interested in issues about justice and criminal reform, do you have any suggestions for that?
So one of the best places that I have found so far is the Women in Prisons Conference is a really good one. But the foundation that actually set that up, Bobin Singh and
the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
Yeah. OJRC. And also, there's some really good places to go. NAIA Family Center, if you're a victim of domestic violence, NAIA Family Center is one of the first places I would suggest going.
That's the Native
American Youth Association. But it's on 50th and Columbia, or the Gateway Center. And domestic violence is never going to stop. They're never going to stop. It's going to end up with somebody in prison, somebody in a box, or somebody horrifically damaged, or losing your children, like to death or the state, something. You have to put a stop to it. Even though it takes a lot of bravery, there are a lot of programs in place to help. The same thing with sexual violence. There's a rape hotline where people just counsel you and they help you walk through these things. There's a sex trafficking hotline. You know, these things, take advantage of those resources. Don't allow yourself to be a victim, because once you get that in your head, you're always going to be a victim, and it's not worth it.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Prison Pipeline. Happy New Year. And I look forward to you joining the collective and sharing more stories and getting more of that insider perspective that we really need for the show.
I am really interested in joining the collective, and I hope that maybe that can be one of my goals for the next 6 months, is that I can join the collective and help reach inmates with what inmates actually need to hear, the things that they want to hear, and give them a voice that maybe they don't have right now.
Well, thank you so much, and have a good night.
You too.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Lion Hotel on the River in Portland. This year, Nelson Senior Vice President of U.S. Strategic Community Alliances and Consumer Engagement, Cheryl Grace, will be the keynote speaker. Grace has been with Nelson for 13 years, and for the past 7 years has overseen the production of a report on Black consumers, and will speak about the power of the Black dollar. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Lion Hotel on the River, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 7 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
Que pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Oi Joaquin, your parte chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, this is...